Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Good afternoon. I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. Welcoming you to The Reasonable Voice's Blog Talk Radio News Program. My guest today is Dr. Marcus Martin, MD, of the University of Virginia. Dr. Marcus Martin has served in a variety of roles in support of diversity and equity at the University of Virginia, including as Assistant Dean in the School of Medicine and as Assistant and Associate Vice President in the UVA Office of Diversity. In 2011, Dr. Martin was appointed Vice President and Chief Officer for Diversity and Equity at University of Virginia. I think that's about the time I met you, or shortly thereafter. But first, welcome to the Reasonable Voices Talk Radio program.
Marcello, thank you very much for inviting me to be on the program. I'm very excited.
It's my pleasure. I do want to say, I just remembered that was about the time I think I met you, somewhere around that time. But I do want to mention a little more for people who don't know you. You are, as a native of Covington, Virginia, You earned bachelor's degrees in pulp and paper technology. I had to say that, 1970. And chemical engineering, 1971, from North Carolina State University, where you were the first African-American varsity football player. Talk about diversity. Tell us a little bit about that. First of all, I'm a little embarrassed because my wife, as you may or may not know, is a professor at University of Virginia in studio art, and she talks about the importance of different paper and all of that, and, you know, I never really got it. So,
awesome work on your part, and, you know, reading the bio and bringing that information out, because I'm proud to be a Virginian. I grew up a little over an hour and a half from here, over in Allegheny County, Covington, Virginia. My wife grew up in Clifton Forge. We're the same age, and we grew up during the Jim Crow era, attended all-black high schools, all-black schools. Mm-hmm. And I had 40 kids in my class, 20 boys and 20 girls, so you got to do everything. I remember, you know, at football games, I would be playing my trumpet in the band with my cleats on and football uniform on. I'd have about 5 minutes after we entertain the crowd. I'd go and get an orange, talk to the football coach, go back on the field and play quarterback on offense and safety on defense. So, you know, doing those types of things gave me the opportunity to participate, to be included. Unfortunately, I couldn't be very good at any of those things, with the exception of math, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. Great story. So my mom, with a 12th grade education, had many siblings. Her father, unfortunately, was killed by a train when she was very young, so she and her siblings did not get a chance to go to college, but she had, you know, high school education, and she was very bright. And her five kids, including me, she pushed us to the limit, and I was helping her on her insurance route. That's how she made part of the living, and my father worked at a laborer at the paper mill. I'll tell you about him in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a middle schooler, and maybe upper level in middle school. I'd ride with her, we'd go collect insurance money, and then we'd come back to the house and have to do the accounting.
Uh-huh.
I would use an old-fashioned crank calculator to put those numbers in, and I couldn't make any mistakes, because when she submitted her report to the insurance company, if we were off, you know, if we didn't report the correct number, she would likely have to pay money out of her pocket, or we would, you know, just lose money. Yeah. So I came to love math, came very competitive with it, and did well in high school, got good grades, and fortunately there was a scholarship to NC State to study pulp and paper technology, as you mentioned. I don't think I would have gotten that scholarship without the great work that my dad did at the paper mill. He was a laborer just like his brothers and my brothers, and so he had a great safety record, and you know, they knew about his children, they knew about me, so I got the scholarship. But I added chemical engineering to it because for some reason to me, just pulp and paper technology by itself, not, you know, quite attractive enough. But unbeknownst to me also, by adding chemical engineering, I was going to end up taking 21, 22 credit hours some semesters, and that was insane.
Wow, yes.
Yeah, my first year now, I did play in a band, play trumpet. Second year, I walked into the football team, and you're right, I became the first African-American varsity football player at NC State. I played, you know, a fair amount of time, particularly on the kickoff teams. And if we were losing big or winning big, you know, as a safety, a cornerback, I would go in and play. So, but I was included and had a great time.
And, you know, and certainly not to minimize all of the firsts you have been as an African-American, but I think part of that is you yourself are so diverse in your interests and in your accomplishments that, how do you think, I mean, my impression is those two naturally go hand in hand. What are your thoughts?
No, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, during the summers when I was an undergrad student at NC State, I had the opportunity to do research at the paper mill and, you know, generate more income. And it's an extensive process in terms of taking the tree and cutting into chips and separating the cellulose, that's the fiber, from the lignin, and then processing bleaching so that you come out with, you know, white paper for writing paper or milk cartons, or, you know, if you don't bleach it, you can use it for brown paper bags or corrugated medium, we call, you know, boxes. And I even research and processes of recycling newsprint. And in some of the cereal boxes, you'll see a gray lining or liner, and that's the combination of the ink print on the paper and the white paper itself, you know, once it's broken down back into fibers and then processed into that particular board, you know, that's used inside the cereal boxes. So for me, having decent grades but not the very best, when it came time to apply to medical school, which I had not planned until I graduated from NC State and worked as a production engineer for about a year and a half, there was a major accident at the paper mill, and I was at that scene just before the accident happened, and was very blessed that I didn't get hurt. Some of my colleagues ended up with broken bones and third-degree burns, and some of them were brought to University of Virginia for care. At that time, I decided I was good at working with mechanical pumps and fluid dynamics and chemicals like caustic soda, but I thought, man, I think I'd like to work with the human heart. So I applied to Eastern Virginia Medical School, which was a brand new school opening up in the state. And lo and behold, I was granted admission to the charter class of 24 students. Now that's one of those stories that I was very, very fortunate. And when I mentor pre-med students now, I'll advise them to apply to 20, 30 or more schools. I was just very fortunate that, that the doors were open for me at Eastern Virginia Medical School. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with the fact that I was doing research during the summertime, and I presented with a can-do attitude, and they had faith in me, and they gave me a chance. And so I've been very blessed.
Now, you were also there. You were the first African-American graduate earning your M.D. in 1976. I got that right?
That's correct. I entered school in September 1976. 73 and graduated on my mom's birthday in September 1976. Now, September is an unusual time to start. Mm-hmm. Usually, if you're starting in medical school, it, you know, could be July or August.
Yes.
But the school opened its doors in 73, and it was not, early on in 73, it was not 100% sure that it could actually take in students, so it was delayed somewhat. Mm-hmm. And it was a three-year school as opposed to the traditional 4 years of study. Mm-hmm. So we studied right through summers, holiday time. You know, we had a few days for Christmas, and that was it. So that was exciting, but it made it tough, you know. It
yes.
was, but we studied together, and I was two African Americans entered that charter class. One, the other person, a male, fell behind, and fortunately later, a few years later, he was able to graduate. But I graduated within that class. Actually, only 23 of us ended up graduating out of the 24. Mm. We lost a few students and we gained a few. But being one minority amongst the majority white students, there were only four women. And so again, back in the 70s, there weren't that many women in medical school. Now, you know,
yes.
in most medical schools, half of the student body is comprised of women. So from the diversity perspective, I walked onto a football team where there were 100 faces, coaches, and other players, and I was the only face of color.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot. I was immersed, essentially, in a different culture.
Yes.
And I learned. I persevered. There was resilience. And then, you know, there's been the other end of the spectrum, just before going to college, being in an all-black environment. And then ultimately, after finishing medical school, going on to become a commissioned officer in public health service and also Indian health service on
yes.
the Navajo reservation.
Oh, yes, yes.
Whole nother culture, yes. yes. So I think the immersion in different cultures prepared me for where I am now
yes.
as a chief diversity officer.
Yes. Wow. That yeah. narrative was so important to hear. And, of course, it's a major part of the reason I asked you to be on the program today. You were also, I should make clear, you were the first African-American to head a clinical department at the University of Virginia. You
yes.
you co-chaired the UVA Health System Diversity Council in 2000, and you were an inaugural member of the UVA Women's Leadership Council? Is that...
That's correct.
All right.
Yeah, yeah, so finishing East Virginia Medical School, I went on to become a commissioned officer in the U.S. Public Health Service, working as an intern in Staten Island at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. Then I went on to New Mexico, Gallup, where mm-hmm. I served as a commissioned officer for, you know, the Indian Health Service,
yes.
Taking care of patients who would come to the hospital in various capacities, whether it was emergency department or whether, you know, pediatric patients and otherwise. And I recall on several occasions delivering babies
the
back of a flatbed truck right outside of the emergency department, learning the culture, learning not to impose my style upon the Native Americans, and also working with the medicine man.
Yes.
And in some situations, the women who would come in labor did not want to come into the hospital. So I've delivered babies on the back of flatbed trucks. And then, you know, women were stable enough to go home, they would go home. And there's a lot of other stories I could tell you. We could take the whole hour just
talking about. And, you know, and
they're all
such great stories because
yeah.
I don't think we are just exclusively nurtured by our natural, our environment. But I do think that has a huge part of things. I don't think that everyone gets an opportunity, but I think those who make the most of whatever opportunities they have. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I've always been impressed with you. And even though I've read your bio before, when I sit and listen here to you tell your story, it's not surprising, shall I say, without minimizing your accomplishments. I understand. I listen to you and I go, well, of course he would be all the things you've ended up being. From what I've seen and heard before today even, you are an integral part of the fabric of the University of Virginia, and as such, you have you've been a part of so many of UVA's accomplishments. I mean, so many, I don't know if we'll get to them all, but let's try. Explain to us, if you would, the community Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. celebration.
Right. So you were mentioning, or mentioned the fact that I came to UVA, and it was 1996.
Yes.
I complete residency training in emergency medicine at the University of Cincinnati, the oldest emergency medicine program in the country. Mm. And then there were a series of firsts. I became the president of the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine, president of the Council of Residency Directors, and so forth. But, you know, spending 15 years at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh,
yes,
trained quite a few physicians. Some I recruited here to UVA who are still here. But I came here as the first African American to chair a clinical department in the School of Medicine, and
yes,
that was the Department of Emergency Medicine,
yes,
for 10 and a half years. After which, the Office for Diversity and Equity was established. And let me just take a minute to say something about that.
Yes.
There were a series of bias incidents that took place in the early 2000s, one around 2002, 2003, I believe, when one of our biracial students, who is African-American and Asian, was accosted when she was running for student council president. And then President Castine, at the time, formed the President's Commission on Diversity and Equity and asked them to study the environment and come back with some recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
And one recommendation was to establish the Office for Diversity and Equity, among many other recommendations.
Yes.
I served on a search committee that recruited the first VP and Chief Officer for Diversity and Equity. That was 2005. Bill Harvey, he was the VP, started in November. And 6 months later, I became his assistant and associate VP. So I joined the diversity and equity team, and we started with these goals: promote an inclusive, welcoming, and respectful environment, and encourage commitment to diversity and equity in all aspects of academics, extracurricular activity, and in the workplace.
Yes.
Yes, and to enhance the student, faculty, and staff experiences. So to enhance or to provide an inclusive, welcoming environment also means to promote some community-related activities and initiatives.
Yes.
And so when President Sullivan came on board in 2010, she asked if I would work towards expanding the MLK community celebration.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, prior to 2010, there may have been one or two activities in the city, one or two activities at the University of Virginia. So ultimately, we coordinated around 225 programs during the Community Martin Luther King Celebration, two-week period in January, averaging about 25 programs annually, which includes guest speakers and panels, panelists, film screenings, and art, entertainment in various forms, all to, you know, honor, reflect, and act on Dr. King's legacy, standing up for justice, reconciliation, and truth. So that's been very successful. The community has been quite engaged. The planning committee includes students, staff, faculty, members of the community, and alumni.
Excellent. We're going to have to take a break now, Dr.
Okay.
Marcus Martin. When we come back, I want to jump in, if we could, with the President's Commission on Slavery and the University, and, of course, the Memorial to Enslaved Laborers. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Marcus Martin, M.D., University of Virginia. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now, enjoy Watchfire Music, featuring vocal artist Julia Wade singing Beautiful from her new CD, Sunday Morning.
Oh, sing unto the Lord a new song. Sing unto the Lord all the earth. For the Lord is great, greatly to be praised. Yes, the Lord is greatly to be praised. Honor and majesty are before Him. Strength and beauty bountiful in his time. Beautiful, beautiful, everlastingly beautiful.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices Doc Radio News Program. My guest today is Dr. Marcus Martin, MD of the University of Virginia. We've talked about his bio in the last segment. There's so much that is so impactful, both for the listeners as well as for those who have never met Dr. Martin. I have met him, I've seen him at work, but I am still being extremely moved by his telling his story. I mentioned at the end of the last segment, Marcus, that you've done so much. You are really sort of in the fabric of the Yep. University of Virginia. And the University of Virginia, I do believe, having you there, has wisely, especially in these the more recent years, the last, what shall I say, maybe 10 years, you correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me, having you there in a certain capacity, they have expanded things that come very naturally to you. And so talk to us a bit about the President's Commission. And by President, we're talking, of course, about the President of the University of Virginia. The President's Commission on Slavery and the University, because there's a history there that not everyone thinks about.
That's correct. And just to tie into what you were saying in terms of the being part of the fabric, having come here in 96 as chair of emergency medicine gave me a good foot into the community. The community would come to the hospital, to the emergency department, and I'd tell people, nobody really wants to come to the emergency room.
Yes.
But if you think about it, people of all walks of life will come in, all human attributes come in to the emergency department. So over time, my sensitivity to various cultures increased, and I taught my students in residents and junior faculty some approaches to cultural competency and also how to recognize biases. And so with that, coming to the Office for Diversity and Equity gave me the opportunity to go more into the community.
Yes.
The university community, we established an LGBT committee. We established a disability advocacy and action committee.
Yes.
And we talked about the MLK Community Celebration Committee. My office coordinates the Women's Leadership Council. There have been a number of other things. You know, we hosted 60 dinners with Julian Bond as a guest of honor between 2007 and 2012, inviting a cross-section of the community to come to these dinners, 25 people at a time. So, you know, we essentially brought in 1,600 diverse individuals over that five-year period with Julian telling some stories and so forth. We established new relationships and rekindled old relationships. Ultimately, in 2013, as President Sullivan was here, I approached President Sullivan and her cabinet, being a member of the cabinet, in April of 2013, about the idea of establishing the President's Commission on Slavery in the University. I was accompanied by Tierney Fairchild, who at the time was the chairperson for the IDEA Fund, Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access. And this is an alumni group that my office established in 2010.
Yes.
We also had some student leadership for the Memorial, at the time they called themselves the Memorial for Enslaved Laborers Group. Going back to 2007, I have to take you back to that time because 2007, the Virginia General Assembly issued a resolution in regret of slavery and called on all Virginians for reconciliation. And that same year, 2007, the UVA Board of Visitors adopted that resolution and placed a monument right at the southwest corner of the rotunda.
Yes.
And that memorial to enslaved laborers is 1 foot wide by about 4 feet long. And it essentially talks about recognizing the free and enslaved several hundred people who helped Thomas Jefferson achieve his design for the University of Virginia. And the time frame was a very brief time frame, 1817 to 1825, that the academical village was erected. First of all, that falls short in terms of image because people step right over that plaque on the ground, don't even know what it is, don't even see it.
Yes.
Furthermore, slavery didn't end until 1865, on March 3rd, here at University of Virginia, where 14,000 enslaved were liberated when Union generals Sheridan and Custer marched into town with 10,000 Union Army members, and the mayor of the Charlottesville and the rector of the University of Virginia, a couple of faculty members, waving the white flag of surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And so since that time, we've been celebrating Liberation and Freedom Day each March 3rd.
Yes.
We've done that the last 3 years. So the picture that I'm painting here is that, yes, there was some commemoration or recognition of enslaved laborers back in 2007, but very inadequate. So synergizing the efforts of the Memorial for Slave Labor student groups, other organizations like UCARE, the Idea Fund,
yes,
my office, and other offices, we were able to present to the president this opportunity, and 6 months later, in September 2013, she established the President's Commission on Slavery and University, and I served as co-chair, and Kurt Von Dyck in the History Department served as co-chair.
Yes.
Establishing that PCSU, as we call it, President's Commission on Slavery and University, we basically added 26 commission members to the commission, students, staff, faculty, alumni, and we created a local and national advisory board and a very important community relations task force that helped us every step along the way.
Mm-hmm.
We held community coffees and forums. We created a documentary, a short one called Unearthed and Understood. We developed narrative content and graphic exhibits related to the history of slavery, placed in the newly renovated rotunda.
Yes.
In that East Oval Room,
yes,
the visitor center. We created the Enslaved African Americans of UVA walking tour, a map that just flies out of the rotunda because people love that map. And then we put on several symposia, Universities Confronting the Legacy of Slavery, University Slavery, Public Memory, and the Built Landscape. And that was during the Bicentennial Gala celebration in 2017, yeah. So we had 61 institutions, 23 states, and the UK participating, and about 500 people to come in and participate in this University Slavery, Public Memory, and the Built Landscape.
Yes.
You know, but ultimately, we named some buildings after the enslaved. We planted a tree on Founders Day back in 2015 in honor of the enslaved.
Mm.
We established a consortium of universities studying slavery, now consisting of 55 schools within the United States, the UK, and Canada. And then some courses, you know, we established courses for students to study in the summertime, mm-hmm, high school students, but also doing the regular semester legacy courses on slavery for our undergraduate students.
Yes.
So it's been a great 5-6 years now. We ended with a report to President Teresa Sullivan. It's about 91 pages long, and it can be accessed by going to slavery.virginia.edu, or you can just Google President's Commission on Slavery University, and the page will come up, and you can see that report. We're ending, in a way, the work of the President's Commission on Slavery University with the erection of the Memorial to Enslaved Laborers. Now, that is a monument that is on equal footing as the rotunda in terms of its diameter.
Hmm.
It's 80 feet in diameter. It's about 40% complete.
Wow.
We hope to complete it by the end of the year or early next spring.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it'll have an inner ring that's a grassy area where the professors can teach classes or students can perform.
Mm.
There can be all sorts of activities there. There will be a wall that progresses up to about 7.5, maybe 8 feet tall, with about 1,000 memory marks, we call it, slashes on the wall.
Yes.
And we will have 1,000 names already engraved on there, 1,000 names of enslaved that we know helped to build this university. And we know there are closer to 5,000 total enslaved who helped to build the university. So as we dig into history and get more names, we'll be able to engrave those names on the wall.
Well, this is most impressive. Where exactly will it be on grounds?
It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's just north and east of the rotunda, just below Brooks Hall.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
Right, close to the corner.
Yeah. Yes. Tell us, I mean, this is all fascinating, Marcus. It's necessary, obviously. It's essential that we get something of your life's experience by experiencing what is now happening at the University of Virginia on grounds And the added, as you say, it's not enough to plaques and statues and things, but you've got to educate people. You've got to make
That's
people,
right.
bring them into the fold, and you're doing all of that. I want to talk before we run out of time, because briefly, I say briefly now, because I heard you were retiring, and I
yeah.
was out of town, and I couldn't connect with you or whatever, and now here you are back. What first of all, tell me about the retirement. What were the plans?
Okay, that's a good one. So January 1st, 2013 was my official retirement date. My staff and family and the university held a wonderful retirement dinner for me at the Boar's Head Pavilion the end of November. My four children, five grandkids were there, and probably 250-300 of my friends and colleagues from the university and the community were there. Well
yes.
represented, quite diverse, including a number of organizations that I'm involved in or boards in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And representing the whole community, from those with disabilities to the different races, ethnicities, women, men, and so forth.
Yes.
And that was a wonderful event. Well, fully expected to retire January 1st. However, the new chief diversity officer search was just beginning in the late fall. And I realized, and President Ryan realized, that it would take a while to get the right person in place.
Yes.
Meanwhile, there are a lot of activities that continue. We have the MLK Community Celebration upon us coming up in January.
Yes.
I serve as the principal investigator of the Virginia North Carolina Alliance, and that's a Lewis Stokes Alliance for Minority Participation National Science Foundation grant to increase underrepresented minorities getting STEM degrees, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Mm-hmm.
Since I'm the principal investigator, I'm the person that has to sign off on the funds.
Yes.
And we've been granted close to $15 million by National Science Foundation over the past 12 years,
yes.
including $1 million to start a program called Bridge to the Doctorate. That's to bring in graduate students so they go through the process 5 to 6 years to get their PhD in STEM fields.
Yep.
Somebody has to sign off on those, and we didn't have anybody in place.
I
agreed to come back after a 30-day sabbatical. You got to stay away. If you retire, you got to stay away.
Yes.
Come back as just a wage faculty, with no university benefits.
Yes.
To continue to lead the office and the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion until we get the new chief diversity officer. Just last week, Kevin McDonald, who is chief diversity officer at the University of Missouri, is the person that President Ryan has hired to take my place, effective August the 1st. I told my wife, we got to hold off just a little bit more. She wants us to do more fishing and crabbing, and I said, I'm ready, but it'll be early August.
It'll be in the heat of August. Not quite yet. Not so fast.
Yeah.
Well, so you were, I guess you answered my other question too, is why did you come back? And because I know you've been busy, but it's clear you had to come back to make this transition happen and to give the university time. And I don't say this as hyperbole. I think it takes time to find someone to follow in your footsteps. I mean, it does. And it had to be a careful search, and I'm glad we had you twice. How's that?
Yeah, I am too. And I've had wonderful opportunities here at the University of Virginia given to me, and I've tried to give back as best I can. When you give back, we were all blessed.
Yes.
A couple of things that have happened in the last couple of years, 2017 towards the end, the university established a professorship of my name, the Marcus L. Martin Distinguished Professorship of Emergency Medicine.
Yes.
A real honor.
Yeah.
There are three professorships now here at the university in the names of African Americans, Julian Bond, Thurgood Marshall, and myself. So, when I think about that company, I am truly blessed. What we need, though, is to establish many more.
Yes.
And for my successor and others going forward, we need more professorships in the names of minorities. We need more diverse professorships. The other thing is, on Founders Day weekend, the university planted a tree in my honor.
Uh-huh.
And the tree is overlooking Memorial to Enslaved Laborers site, looking down towards the hospital, looking over towards Madison Hall where, I come to work every day.
Yes.
And I said in my comments upon doing that ceremony that if that tree could see could talk, that years from now when my grandchildren and great-grandchildren come by and to visit a tree, you know, I hope the seeds we've planted in diversity, equity, inclusion would have grown as strong as that oak tree would have grown itself by that time.
Yes.
And I won't be around to see it, but they will.
Well, that's a beautiful thought. I'm sorry that we have to go, Marcus. It's just been an absolute pleasure to talk with you again. I think it's been 3 or 4 years since we've done a radio show.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. And we should also mention, you know, you breezed right through the, you know, you're a principal investigator of the National Science Foundation, Virginia North Carolina Alliance, and of course, that's extremely important. But what I want to mention, too, that you've been party in increasing the number of minority students earning degrees in science and technology and engineering and math by an astounding 174%.
Yes, sir.
Wow.
Yes, within our lines. Yep.
You know? And yet still there's so much more to go. I mean, I don't want to diminish anything with this comment, but I just want to say when I first started living here, at least part-time, I was asked to direct and I won't even name it now because all the personnel has changed, but it was a historical reenactment production, and I did it. But my first question when the all-white board asked me to join and be a part of it, I said, that's great, and let's hold auditions. And when the auditions came, I turned to them and I said, well, where are the African Americans and the American Indians? I mean, really, you know, I mean, Native Americans, and how can you tell the history if... And they really, Marcus, they really stared at me like they just couldn't understand why I was asking. Anyway, we did it, and we fixed it at least the year I was there.
Okay. And our university guides, our students who give tours of the lawn, basically have included the very information you're just talking about, the history of African Americans here and Native Americans at the University of Virginia.
We couldn't have the University of Virginia without it, and that's no exaggeration. Marcus, please take us out. Dr. Marcus Martin, take us out with how we continue to help with your successor, the work that you have so well founded and rooted for us on grounds. What can we do? How do we follow up so that your work is constantly sustained? How's that?
One talk that I gave on Black Alumni Weekend, April 6th of this year, was on past, present, and future diversity, equity, inclusion at the University of Virginia. And that speech can be accessed at, you know, my website, at the Office of Diversity and Equity website. It's relatively long, but it talks about the accomplishments. You know, we've done well collectively as a university and community, increasing the number of minority students. Last year's class was the most diverse ever. This upcoming year's class is going to be even more diverse. You know, over 10 years, we've increased underrepresented minority undergraduate students by 40%, and the same with graduate students. And the number of minority teaching and research faculty, we've increased by 70%. So that's significant, but the raw numbers need to continue to increase.
Mm-hmm.
The community needs to continue to work together to be, you know, a loving community, supportive of the students that come here. And the new chief diversity officer, he will be vice president for diversity, equity, inclusion, will also assume the responsibilities of the Equal Opportunity and Civil Rights Office. He will need support. His name is Dr. Kevin McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
He will need support. And Jim Ryan is on the right path in terms of advancing the work that's already been done.
Yes.
I think the community has an open door to President Ryan. He established the working committee related to community that will continue to serve him in an advisory capacity. But I will be meeting with Dr. McDonald next month, and we'll let him know about this conversation. And certainly we'll pass on to him all the things that we've been doing here, and hopefully we'll continue and surpass those things we've done so far.
Excellent. All right, then. Thank you so much, Dr. Marcus Martin of University of Virginia, MD. I've rattled off your credits. They are, I think the greatest thing I can say about them, they are expansive, they are varied, but they are very much at the very fiber of America's diversity.
Thank you, sir.
Everything you've done in your life is now, because of what you've done at university, it's like you just laid it out. This is what I've learned from living, and now I'm sharing it with you through the University of Virginia. Thank you so much, Dr. Marcus Martin, for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. All the best in this retirement this second time around.
Yes,
okay?
Sir. Absolutely.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Here is Stoll Fawn singing Forgiveness.
I got ghosts here in my way. Yeah, they haunt me every day. They got reasons and they got plans. Take me out when they get their chance. And I can tell you why they're here. That won't make them disappear. I ain't saying I'll forget it. All their wrongs will ever be right. We're just talking about forgiveness. How it gives you back your love. It's never easy being torn apart. Forgive to be forgiven, and it'll open up your heart.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. It's time to question how we bring home what's been lost. Who taught us to focus on rude, crude posturing instead of distinguishing ourselves as everyday heroes sans headlines? What will it take to shift from problem fascination to solution focusing? When will we divorce bewildering bellowing, marry wisdom that permeates time out, and rebirth the family value of peaceful assembly? Where, in a land of the free, does being a patriot award freedom to belittle with abject name-calling or the liberty to assign angry adjectives to nouns of diversity? Why do we increasingly flock like sheep to baa at behest of blah-blah of over-consumerism, over-zealous zealots, and over-aged politicians pimping redundancy of wolves in sheep's clothing as the new world order for the natural order of things? 1. Keeping women in their place. 2. Children seen but not heard. 3. LGBTQ Muslims and Mexicans banned from real citizenship. And finally, the South shall rise again. For real. How can we continually turn a blind eye to the consequential discrepancy between an NRA mea culpa projecting the fault of its internal morality hemorrhage as a victim of North aggression? Who can overlook the hourly pretension of media hyperbole accelerating Fourth Estate demise, partnering with the pomposity of a pretender-in-chief tweeting unsubstantiated slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? What exactly about democratic socialists so irritates conservatives' anti-inclusive, short-sighted militia itch and exposes anti-American lock-and-load threat to Trump's damaging horde and his damaged objectives alike? Both struggling for very different Americas in a racist presidential swamp, depositing them in an inequitable economic bog. Where is any possible Trump-Pence sting when those who so love the world love it enough to save all life upon it? Because you see, hate, as a right-wing required acquired taste, is only digestible family value in the hearts manipulated into harboring it. Why is it that the 2/3 of these United States for whom the natural order of things has evolved from civil war mutating into Jim Crow laws, which embolden the Ku Klux Klan and ultimately a reality show invasion of all levels of American government, still settles for a rerun of maniacal McCarthyism scare tactics? How can we not now vote, no matter how tattered our elections and political parties, to resurrect from Trump ashes a Good Samaritan patriotism that is honor-bound, to elect champions inspired by a duty-bound electorate demanding an all-inclusive American dream? While banning Muslims, spreading presidential manure on less fortunate countries, restricting marriage licenses, gunning down each other in schools, workplaces, and places of worship, we fail our definite major purpose to, as stewards, preserve, protect, and defend the earth and all life upon it. How else, then, do we emerge from Slave Bible, Green Book, and faith movies through FDR, JFK, MLK, to AOC, a ratified ERA, an incorruptible DOJ? We do so when we stand tall and deliver on the promises we've preached. Colorblind justice, individual eradication of sexual harassment, gender bias, radical bigotry, and the religious hypocrisy of insulting biblical lessons like love thy neighbor as thyself with the asterisk, as long as my neighbor looks and thinks as I do. Who among us remembers what America can do when we look for miracles in each other? What contribution can't rainbows mingling with LGBTQ, people of color, and descendants of immigrants make to the United States of America? When will we stop demanding change but voting for those who can't yet fathom there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in a conservative Republican's philosophy? Where is home for a third of Americans who reject the abundant potential of an in-depth foundation of democratic miracles? And why do we forget we didn't have a clue for a cure for tuberculosis, smallpox, polio, mumps, measles, chickenpox, and the flu until we did? So what's next? Climate change and climate injustice. How can America find its way home through the aftermath of Trump confirming what is past is prologue by allowing our Gettysburg Address to define each of us to all of us? To the degree, as country and individual, we discover and digest the direct line of America's ascending homegrown tyranny in our nation's current trajectory through Nixon's Watergate, Reagan's trickle-down, Bush-Cheney's Great Recession, we will understand how we were bathed in the racism, sexism, religious hypocrisy, and white supremacist prep for Trump-Pence. When, if not Tuesday, 3 November 2020, will we progress from our sea to shining sea troubles, and by opposing William Barr, Stephen Moore, Mnuchin, Mitch McConnell, Pence, Trump, vainglory mirage, end their reigning weight on our backs? For the freeing truth that hurts most is, ignorance is not bliss. Denial is the opiate of cowards, and change is terrifying. But progressing forward anyway is the courage of unsung heroes, for without the valiant, humanity and its planetary home are doomed. So now, let us invite the wisdom that comes from investigation, making we the people the affirmation to never again tolerate what we ourselves have wrought. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.